So why should we care about echoes? Because, you know, echoes don't necessarily sound like the most exciting thing to look at with a supernova. But, you know, exactly. So that's why I was going to say is normally you'd have to go and explain that people have seen echoes for several supernovae and done useful things with them. But fortunately, Peter took care of all that, so I don't have to do it. But anyway, echoes have been seen in several objects and used in useful ways. The other thing is that the echoes tell you something about the dust around the supernova. So in some sense, you could try to reconstruct other information about the evolution of the progenitor. It's a complicated problem, but in principle, you can learn something from that. The other thing is that you should be able to find these echoes for a long time after the explosion. So it gives you a way of looking back into the past, other than the normal way that we look back in the past astronomically. And the other thing is that, you know, if we can see these things that are happened hundreds or thousands of years ago, this gives us a chance to go back and actually look at the same object that Tycho and Kepler and Galileo did, which is, you know, kind of cool to have this direct connection, sort of the start of supernova astronomy. And the other thing is that if you can actually get enough light from the echo, you can take a spectrum of the echo and see the supernova itself as it happened, well after it took place. Because you can see that spectrum of the early time, you actually get to study but not only the supernova remnant, but the supernova itself. And so you actually get to see both components, which is not something we've been able to do before. So, how did we find the echoes? Well, this was sort of an accidental discovery that fell out of the Supermacho project. And the Supermacho project is a microlensing survey looking at the LMC. So they come by and they look at this with some frequency, looking for variations in the light curves of various objects towards the LMC. And so they're looking for microlensing events, but what they find are variable stars and supernovae behind the LMC and things like that. But what you do have is you have this amazingly consistent data set where you keep imaging the LMC over and over and over. And here's the whole collaboration that was working on this, and you can see that, again, it's Armin and all these people on Supermacho, and then I come in at the very bottom. Okay, so this is using the CTIO, the Mosaic camera on the 4 meter, and they have 30 half nights per year for 5 years. This is done over a 3-month season to look at the LMC as it's up in a nice, good observing position from the south. And they're doing this about every other night, looking at the LMC. And then they difference the images to look for any changes, to look for the microlensing event.
Is this the same cadence as the essence? Is this also the essence?
The other half of the night.
The other half of the night is essence, but the cadence is... Yeah. And the same pipeline for the...
Armin.
Yes.
The essential principle.
The cadence is actually not the same, though. The cadence is not the same because they're going every other night on the same fields. In essence, we have more fields, so we go every 4 nights. Yes. So that's there is a difference. They're covering different fields. As everyone knows who's done any difference imaging, you get a lot of false alerts. And they were expecting to see false alerts around 87A because the echo was known. There were known to be light echoes around 87A. And there were a lot of other things that sort of appeared that they didn't really know what they were. But the light echoes from 87A were fairly obvious in their image tracking. So, you know, that's a nice clean detection. It's pretty clear that you're looking at the echo of 87A there.
It does seem to be a little
odd. You mean
that they're not concentric circles?
Well, because the dust is not uniform. In fact, I'll show you later, there's a model of sort of a convoluted dust sheets that may or may not be correct, but shows that it is a complicated situation. So again, here's a different series. And you can actually sort of see as we go from that previous year, let me get out of the way so you can see this, that it actually changes position because the rings are actually expanding as the light moves out through the dust sheet. The ring, the reflection is, yes, how's that? You know, not physically expanding.
Delayed surface is expanding.
That's right. All right. Okay, now you want to talk about delay surfaces. Here you go. All right. So, as you all know, the parabola provides you the surface of constant time for the reflections from the supernova. And so what you're doing is as you look at these rings, you're sort of sampling these different places along these parabolas as the echo moves out through these dust sheets in the LMC.
It's really an ellipse.
Yeah. Right, but it's a very close to a parabola when the axis is so big. So, here's that example. This is a model of where these dust sheets might be to produce the pattern that you see here. Okay, so this is, and I will refer you to the paper for the details of how they work this out. I will not try to explain it. But anyway, that's right. But the point is that it's not a simple structure as you might imagine. Things are complicated in how dust is distributed in the interstellar medium. So, you know, the surfaces are not nice, you know, perpendicular planes of dust that give you a nice clean echo. Of course, in all subsequent stuff, we will assume that for everything that we do. But you know, you have to know that you're not really looking at a simple distribution of dust in the ISM, in the LMC. But yeah, so that's why it doesn't look uniform. Yeah. I mean, you also, well, there are two possibilities. You could also have different sheets of dust at different points on the constant time ellipse, or you're seeing different epochs of dust, or different epochs of light, dust at a different position. It could go both ways, or something like that. And in principle, since we actually have these things expanding over time, you get proper motion and the evolution of the ring. So you can, that's how you can try to disentangle that information to produce these light, these dust sheets.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. But that only applies really for 87A because it. So, you can model what the brightness ought to be for the light scattering off these dust sheets, and you know there are geometrical factors about how the light travels to the dust sheet to come to us, and there's a scattering function in here about how the light scatters off the dust, and various other parameters involving the density and then the distribution that will tell you what you expect the surface brightness to be. And so what you can do, though, is you can actually say, okay, well, if I know we have 87A and we see another echo, what we can do is we can actually compare the two. And so it's these ratios that really enable you to learn something about the other echoes relative to what you learn from 87A. Because for 87A, we know when it exploded, which is a useful thing to know. And so you can then do all these comparisons with other objects directly back to that. And that's how, in combination with geometrical effects, you can learn about the dust from these other echoes, as well as infer things like the age of the supernova and things like that. And so it basically comes down to looking at the surface brightness that you see in the echo will change relative to the original magnitude of the supernova, the distance to the dust sheet, and the time of explosion, and however you compute the scattering function, which you sort of more or less treat as the scattering is happening the same for the different supernovae. And in fact, the way they treated this and the way Armin did to actually do this full calculation that's in the Nature paper on the echoes, they just used pure forward scattering, basically, for this. So what you can do is apply even more complicated or refined techniques for doing the image subtraction, and this is using N times N minus 1 over 2, which is basically the differencing all the images together. This is what Tonry and Barris developed for doing the IZ supernovae. And so this is being applied in the same way to the image subtraction we do here, where they're sort of using all the information to subtract all the frames from each other in order to highlight where exactly all the differences are. And so when you do that, you can see that in just a regular difference, you can see these echoes out here. But if you do this full thing, you can actually pull up even more subtle, sort of the lower surface brightness parts of the echo. So you can actually see much more of the echo itself by doing this process. It's really just a different image processing technique to bring out that finger thing. But I just wanted to show you this to see, you know, the extent of the echo. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the process, but if you're using all of the data, how do you manage to get the time variability? Oh, well,
right, yeah, this the time variability we don't get from that part of the analysis. You get that from looking at the sort of the individual subtractions as you go along. Mm-hmm. Right. This is just to find sort of the grand total of what you might see and where we can look for that.
So it's sort of an integral in a sense.
Yes, that's right. That's one way of looking. So that was supposed to be a movie that didn't work out. So anyway, the other thing is that when they went and looked, they were still looking for, you know, these microlensing candidates, and they were still finding these little places where the subtraction didn't work right. And usually when that doesn't work right, there's an AGN or a supernova or there's an asteroid or something. But then they discovered that some of these places where there was always a residual, they ended up in the same place every time. So it wasn't going away. And in fact, they had these nice little linear structures that were appearing in these different images that weren't really expected to be there. So this was kind of the surprising thing. They expected to see something from 87A. They did not expect to see these other echoes.
The field.
This is the field. That's the subtraction. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is the problem in the LMC, is that it's almost all stars. Yes. So when you go look at these things, where they had, this is 87A down here, they had little linear structures around here and around here. And so basically they found three relatively consistent sets of these little sheets of light moving out. And in fact, the way, from the proper motions, they could sort of point back to where the center of these things were in each of these three cases. And it turned out that in each of those three cases, it pointed back to a position that was a known supernova remnant. So at that point, they realized, okay, that's what this is. It's a light echo of one of these old supernovae. And then they could play the same game of using that function I showed you before of comparing the surface brightness of 87A to these guys. And that gave them some estimate for how old each of these individual supernovae might be, using that function I showed you before about how the surface brightness would change with the age. So in fact, what they found is that they were looking at three of the six youngest supernova remnants, with counting 87A as a remnant. It was these three that turned up with echoes. And it turns out they were all ones that were thought to be type 1A beforehand based upon X-ray spectra. And were there other things besides that, Carlos, or was it just the X-ray spectra?
Other circumstantial evidence.
Okay. Okay. So there were other lines of evidence that pointed to this. And then based upon the surface brightness seen in those dust sheets, these are the ages that were calculated for these various remnants. So when you're asking what ancient meant, this is what ancient means in this context. So these things is 400 years old, 600 years old. Everything is relative. but again, remember I said that this assumes a pretty simple dust distribution, so it could be more complicated than this.
The error bars reflect that?
I assume there are other components that go into the error as well, but I'm sure that the dust distribution is the dominant source of the uncertainty. So when you look at that, you might think, okay, well, now that we know that we have a supernova remnant, these things are, you know, relatively bright, so it might be something that you could go get a spectrum of. And so that was the next step in the process. So that's what we did. This is using Gemini South, using nod and shuffle mode, because that's basically what you have to do in this really complicated region, because there's so much stellar continuum contaminating the spectrum that you have to observe the field, nod well off to get a clean spot, and then use that to subtract off from underneath your supernova. And it's a very expensive observation, because because basically you're observing on your source only half the time, because the other half you're well off trying to get the background. And of course, moving a telescope in that nod takes an equivalent amount of time. So really, you're observing for a third of the time, which, you know, the techs don't really like to hear that you're doing that with the telescope. it worked in this particular case. We could see here is where we put down little slits from a mask on top of those little arcs that you saw from the light echoes themselves, summed up that light, and we got something that, you know, has nice broad features that look like a supernova. Now, the spectrum may not look exactly like a supernova to you, and there are a couple of reasons for that. One is, of course, the scattering, you know, changes the slope. The other is that you're not seeing that supernova spectrum at a single time. This is the supernova spectrum integrated over the whole light curve, because you're seeing the whole history reflected off that dust sheet. So this is really sort of an integrated average of a supernova spectrum. Now, of course, it's heavily weighted to maximum because that's where all the light is. But so it's close to a maximum, but you know, it's sort of a light weighted average of those things.
What is the time span that completely flows? Is it like 10, 15 days around maximum?
Yeah, I'd say plus or minus 10 days is probably where almost all the signal is in here.
Is there like a model that
emulates
these processes, or it's just a single epoch?
Oh, the model, no, the fitted spectrum, no. We've taken a series of spectra of various objects and then done a convolution in the same way the dust sheet would, yeah, and also including the scattering to try to take in the shape, take into account the shape as well. This is something that exactly, yes, and this is Jose Luis Prieto, who's a grad student at Ohio State, is the one who's done this work of developing the tools to take observe nearby supernovae and find this kind of best match to the spectrum. Right. Gotcha. And so this is for LIDAR 2. This is the brightest one, of course, so I'm showing you the best data we've got. But on the other hand, when you look at it, you can actually see, you know, there really are features there, and it really looks like the type 1A. I mean, more than it looks like any other type of supernova. And I'll show you the others in a minute. but anyway, so that's pretty convincing. And the good thing about this is a direct picture of the supernova as it exploded. So the remnant we only had as, you know, something that we inferred that it must be 1A based upon, you know, the X-ray spectrum and other things. Here we actually have direct confirmation of that, which made Carlos very happy that it turned out the way he thought it would. Yeah. We put down slits in various locations, right? Because the echoes have various parts of it. And yeah, so I did. I looked at separate pieces, and then before I combined everything together, and they were more or less consistent. The problem is, of course, is that any individual slitlet was so weak that the noise made intercomparison kind of hard to do. But you did see the supernova features in every one, at least for this brighter object. Which was good, because that meant it wasn't something that was wrong with that slit, and it was also, there were also other slits that were not on the supernova that did not show this structure. Also good. So it's not an observational or reduction effect that's producing the features we see here. We only saw this in the slits that were put onto the light echo itself, not on the regions that were not on the light echo. So there it is, smooth, so you can see how much better it fits when you ignore the noise.
Does it have an effective age? I mean, this looks a little older than maximum. So is there like is it like 5 days is kind of the...
No, I think it's pretty much weighted by the light curve. So
when we play that game, when we step on, you could do that. You could take that spectrum and see what game you could follow.
Right.
Well, we
would
have different ages as a function of
the time. Right. Yeah. Our band would be older and
so would age that
broad.
We can answer that.
Right? Yeah.
What would you get?
Of course, that may also tell you that we have that of the supernova that went into these the individual supernovae that went into the low redshift comparison, we have more data after maximum than before. It might be weighted on that side a little bit just because of an observational bias. Anyway, here it is versus a 1BC template. I'm not sure which 1BCs went into this. And, you know, it arguably it's not a terrible fit here, but it's not as good as it was for the 1A.
Yeah, but sometimes we don't have the booster. And there are no published, not published good sets of the really blue 1Cs, right? You know, it's probably 94i or something which was there.
Right, but there are other 1BC spectra that Armin is going to use. Is that not right for this comparison?
I'm sure there are observed objects, and there are also the, what was it, AW, it's just this one guy that's really blue, similar to 1A, and I'm sure it's going to get.
Yeah, but in looking even at the individual ones we've got, it none of them really fit as well as the 1As do. I mean, you're right. I mean, there's a degeneracy in the way these spectra look that make it hard to be 100% certain, but it's still more likely that it's a 1A than a 1B.
Oh. Do these comparisons look that different from the
we'll let you handle that one. Okay, but on the other hand, you can clearly see it's not a type 2, so we know that much, okay? So that's.
But it seems to me we can use the same technique for a type 5 that we use for the essence guys and so on, which is the thing that said on the
podcast
last week.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think.
We don't have to just move
that. Right. I mean, the integration does change things a little bit, but I don't know. Oh, you mean for the echo? No, this is it. This was a pilot error on the part of the person observing that we did not get the full range that we wanted to get. I didn't say who it was. Okay, so here's the smooth version of Light Echo 3. This is a different one. This one is the next the brightest one. And you look at that and it's like, well, not quite as convincing as the other one. the dips and wiggles do appear in the same place as the other one. So it's. I'll show you another slide that's slightly more convincing than that.
What is the surface brightness?
LE3 is 23, I think. 22.8 for that.
Wow.
It's hard to do. And we've got another one that's even fainter than that.
How much time did you spend on that with Gemini?
You don't really want to know.
You want to know.
No. For this is about, I think all told for all three echoes, it was about 45 hours.
45 hours on Skunk.
Yeah. But it was not distributed uniformly. The bright one was probably 10 hours, and then the other two were some
over.
That's the thing you really don't want to know, is the overhead. So here, let me show you. Here's the three spectra. So that LE3, in this representation, that's a little more convincing than the one on the other one. So, you know. LE2, this is the first one we did. So, you know, I saw this and I'm like, hey, good. Then I saw this one, it's like, well, okay, maybe marginally believable. Then we did this one, which is really faint. This is like 23.5 surface brightness. And so you look at that, it's like, well, you know, maybe, if you squint at it just right, it kind of looks like the others, but it's not. I mean, if I didn't have these two, there's no way you would be convinced by this at all. And, you know, you maybe you aren't even convinced by looking at it now either.
Is this random associated
with I can't remember which one it was. I have no idea. It's the older one.
And one of these.
Sure.
What's that line there? Is it HL?
You mean this or this? This? I think that's that was a flaw in the reduction. So that's my fault.
Since I brought it up, it might be interesting to know that while the other two are very clear cut cases from the extra point of view, 0519 and 0519, and 103B is a little weirder. And we're pretty sure it has a circumstellar interaction. And there's no Balmer dominated shot around it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of interesting.
Okay. Well, that's something. I mean,
not to be over-interpretive, of course. But
well, I mean, we are trying to go back and look at these in a little more detail, and there's some talk of even trying to go back and redo the exact same positions because the light echoes move away, and so we could go back and redo the same spot and get the exact continuum underneath and use that to subtract out and get a much better, because you know there's still a lot of stellar continuum in here that we haven't really been able to take out quite right. I was going to say, the LMC is kind of a problem at that time. No. But it's understood. Yeah, you never. Yeah.
You show the comparison with attack 2 for LED3. But is it the best match with attack 2 or just a comparison to show that?
That was versus LE2. Yeah. That was just to show that it didn't, that there were no good matches with a type 2 for that LE2. Okay. So here are the conclusions. It's basically the things to take away from this are that, well, number one, we can find these guys of old supernovae, so that's good. What we can do is, for one thing, for 87A, there's enough information there that you can actually learn something about the dust in the LMC. The other thing is that by actually going back and finding the spectra of these brighter things, we can actually look and see what these guys were. I mean, we can actually say something really concrete about the progenitors of these remnants, which is a good thing. And this way, we can actually relate directly the explosion mechanisms at the start and the way the remnants look now. So this is a good way to finally bring a much more direct connection between remnants and supernovae, because we have a way to actually say which is which. Now, the obvious thing to do now is to look for these things in the galaxy. And so that's what Armin is doing right now, is using the mosaic camera both north and south to try to look at galactic remnants to find these light echoes. And once the echoes are there, then we can go back and try the same game of doing the spectrum. So the long-term goal is to actually go back and find what Tycho and Kepler saw when they saw their supernovae. Thanks. Right.
And they're all potential type 1A.
That's right.
So have people thought about that? And maybe
they're bright.
That's right.
That selection again.
They're young.
Well, it might be younger type 2s, but 1As are the brightest. Mm-hmm.
There is actually some hint of a fourth echo, but that still is a little uncertain. I think they're going to wait for the analysis of the seedings worth of data to see
if that. It also happens that in the LMC, for some reason, most of the young remnants, well, all of them except 87A, we thought were 1A.
It's not
0.40. 0.40 is not that.
So if you look at, you know, in spiral galaxies, if you look at the 1A rate to the core collapse rate, it's about 1 in 3.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand here, which of the sky you've gotten with the LMC, are you finding that it's 50-50, that the 1A rate is the core collapse rate?
Well, this is not really...
It's a small number.
No,
but if it was 3-1.
Yeah, it's one of those statistics, but already the one direction.
But if you had a magnitude thinker or supernovas, yeah.
I mean,
we have a third and a half magnitude per square second.
Yeah, they'd be fainter, I mean... You don't cover the whole.
I'm trying to digest then your bullet here. When you say you can establish
Oh, okay. Yeah. No. Sorry. This is Armin's long term hope. I would say that right now there's no way we do not have the information.
The answer is you won't step.
Yes.
Let's forget about it. But what about the absolute rate of type 1As in the LMC?
Right.
That you have. Right. Okay. You missed all the type 2s. There are lots of type 2s. I'm not sure it's very convincing. But let's say you did. Oh, Armin. Oh, well. And so
yes,
you have four type 1As in a millennium. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's
careful. How do you know how long the time interval is?
1,000 years. Is that what
you said? The oldest is 860, and I gave you a little bit more just to be generous.
He doesn't know how old the oldest one that didn't see is, which is what you need to know.
Okay, 300,000 years. That's still a high rate. What's the star formation rate in the LMC?
So it's about a 1/10 of the Milky Way, right?
Yeah.
So that gives you a very high. That gives you a very high type 1A rate.
So there's a lot of star formation. The current star formation rate is pretty high.
That's what I'm asking. So the question
I know,
is it consistent? Well, maybe there are things.
Yeah,
it's not
surprising. We already did this from the
Jack
and I. Yeah. Did that arithmetic, didn't we?
And,
and it comes out to be 100, 400 years, and that's okay.
Yep. Given the star formation.
Yeah.
I know I've read it, but I
don't think that 95 big. I'm not sure.
And those are super good X-ray solids.
Well, I'm just saying, I mean, I think we've got some rough measures of the 1A rate and functional star formation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just curious whether this compares.
Well,
how this compares.
Exactly. And, but it's the same as the rate that you estimated from the X-ray identification of the X-ray spectrum, saying which ones were 1As. It's the same story. There's no new objects. It's the same objects. And we knew that they were, we thought they were 1As.
Okay.
And this is, you know, this is consistent. And the other thing that's really good is you didn't go overboard and say that that third one in one of 3Ds is for sure a 1A, because it isn't for sure. And so that's very good. Everybody has
it's
shown good sense.
Than the others.
Well, so far we'll see what comes out in the final paper.
I have another question. This dust that the light of the supernova is being reflected around, does it need to be associated with the supernova itself?
No, this
is 100
parsecs away. Yeah.
See, in A7A, it has nothing to do with the circumstellar stuff. It's just some dust cloud on the line of sight. It's really amazing. And of course, this is all supernovae, everybody.
What about the populations of stars around these objects? I mean, we're looking at, if you take a look at the regions where you found each of them, are the stars around them young stars, or are they primarily old stars?
I don't know
the
answer
only
to that question.
Research that's been done is A7A. Where it's a separate story, but because we were taking HST images, you know, over and over and over again, we built up an incredibly big catalog of the neighborhood. And one of Neil Panagia's students did a stellar synthesis to try to estimate the age of the population, and sure enough, you know, there were some massive stars there. It was fairly recent.
Without doing such a thorough job of having all this HST data, I mean, can't you just look at it and say, well, yeah, there are some young stars there, and the LMC is near enough?
We can't do it from this data, though, because the supermuch imaging is in a single filter that is non-standard. So it would be hard to do stellar populations from that information.
Is it not being looked at in more detail by other people?
It's want to look at how stars.
Yeah.
So that means HST. And I don't know. How do we look?
Yeah, there may be.
You can look at the H2 maps and.
Massey did the, what was it called, the local group survey, right? I'm not sure. Because they called it the local group survey, I'm guessing they did the LMC.
Yeah, you can totally. So people have made catalogs of the massive stars, for sure.
Yeah.
Like Phil. And before that, St. Louis.
Just see if there's anything new there. That's an interesting question.
Yeah, no, I think that would be a very useful thing to do. No, I think knowing the population would be a good thing to do.
It's a good point. Yeah. It's a good point.
We've been doing that for M31 for the supersoft sources.
Yeah.
What are the ages of
the
populations, right? And it's maybe a little different than what we thought. It'd be interesting to see what it's like for you there.
It's a good point.
And it would be easier to do.
I always get confused. What LMC is a third or a fifth solar? What is a third?
Not a third.
Yeah.
SMC
is lower. So
SMC is lower.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is there a way to get depth information on GPS into LMC?
Behind the dust.
Go around
yeah, that's about it. and the other thing, even that's kind of the distance from the dust sheet is still kind of an estimate. I mean, that's not a really hard number. So, you know, you don't really know you know a relative sense, but you don't know the full structure.
There might be more to say about that.
Yeah, I mean, you could use a little bit with the
ball. None of those X-ray remnants are very absorbed. From absorption within the that at least not that I recall.
There's also sicker imagery of it that might help to sort of untangle some of it, where the dust is relative to the one. That might be a good way to do it.
Yeah, there's one.
Okay, so we thank Tom. Okay, Paul, you're up.